Today on The Grave Talks, we continue our conversation with author Eric Freeman Sims about the legends of Tennessee. We mentioned the Battle of Franklin being the five bloodiest hours of the Civil War, but the Shiloh National Military Park, that battlefield saw a lot of death.
Yeah, about 20,000 dead between both sides.
I can't even wrap my brain around that.
Yeah.
There were
so many killed, but people and horses, that there's a pretty good sized pond that turned red with blood.
Yeah, because you think 20,000. You can go to a concert at the arena right here, and if it's sold out, that's 15,000.
Yeah.
You know, that's just, it's just overwhelming to think about.
Yeah.
Is the Shiloh National Military Park, where exactly is that?
That is in West Tennessee, kind of south along the Mississippi border.
Does that location have reports of hauntings?
There's all kinds of reports of haunting at Shiloh.
There has to be.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really a stupid question.
There's lots of sounds of course, battles going on, gunshots, cannon fire, things like that, men screaming. Horses is another one, like I talked about at Carnton with the Battle of Franklin. But the heaviest part of the fighting was at a place called the Hornet's Nest, and people hear footsteps, a lot of footsteps there, like somebody's walking up behind them, there's nobody there. That's kind of something throughout the park too, but that area seems to be the predominant area for that. And they also have seen soldiers that they think are reenactors marching across the battlefield, and they turn, you know, they blink their eye and they're gone. And then also the sound of marching soldiers. They hear moaning and screaming, you know, all this crazy sounds. There's one story about a little drummer boy that I put in the book, because people still hear the sound of drums beating. And the drummer boy was 11 years old, and he was killed during the battle. The story goes that a Union officer told him to play the drum sound for retreat, but instead he sounded the attack. And that resulted in the Union driving the Confederates back, and it kind of turned the course of the battle. So this little drummer boy kind of became a hero in folklore. But when they were working on putting a new road, they actually dug up a skeleton of a child with the remnants of a drum buried with him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They say that you can still hear him beating his drum throughout the battlefield. And there's actually a song that this guy wrote back after in the late 1800s called The Drummer Boy of Shiloh. And you can still find that that sheet music online.
And going back to Franklin, because I have a personal tie to that, because my grandfather was at the Battle of Franklin, went on to the Battle of Nashville, where that was his last battle. He left, went on. He had a really interesting life, too. His 20 Civil War battles, which I don't know how he made it, but then ended up going in a covered wagon out to Nebraska and started. He had the first frame house in Nebraska, in that county in Nebraska.
Wow.
As a trading post, and him and Buffalo Bill were very good friends. So, like, this man led this really fascinating life.
Yeah.
So I took a trip to Franklin to kind of wrap my brain around a little bit of his, at least where he was. So we did get some information on him, and we went to the Carter House. But they also mentioned about the Lotz House. And I don't know if I heard it from some of the other tourists that were there, but everyone was talking about how that's the haunted house. And the Carter House, definitely I felt stuff in the Carter House. I don't know how you couldn't with all the loss of life that happened around there in the Carton plantation. What do you know about the Lotz House?
So the Lotz family was a German family. Johann Lotz, the father, was a master woodworker. And so when he built their house, he built it out of wood. So it was wood siding and everything was wood to show off his skills. And so during the Battle of Franklin, they went across the street to the Carter House because the Carter House was brick, and that would better protect them from cannonballs and musket fire and things like that. So they huddled in the basement of the Carter family. Several cannonballs came through the roof of the Lotz House during the battle. There were all kind of bullet holes throughout the house. The house was kind of almost fell down because of all the bullet holes and the cannon holes in the roof and the floors and things, because the cannonball would come through the roof and go straight through the second floor and landed in one of the rooms downstairs. Wow. There's still a burn hole in the gift shop from a cannonball where it where it hit the wood floor. To this day, you can see that. But Thomas, who is the director of the Lotes House now, he used to be the director of Carter House for like 25 years. He's a historian and a very, he's forgotten more about the Civil War than we'll ever know. He's a Civil War historian. And for 25 years, he was the director of Carter House. And the thing about Carter House is that they have a separate office that's new on the grounds. Mm-hmm. So when they're not given tours, they don't hang out in the house. Well, Lotes House is different because Lotes House, their offices are in the house and their gift shop and everything's in the house. So when he retired from Carter House, he went over to become the director of Lotes House. He didn't believe in the paranormal, never had a paranormal experience at Carter House. But at Lotes House, within the first week, he became a believer because the things they captured on the cameras and things that he would come in to find. They, on the gift shop counter, they have a bowl of mini balls, which were the type of ammunition they used in muskets and things back then. And he would find them. They would lock up and go home for the night and come back in the morning, and they would be stacked up like dominoes through the house. And they'd even find them upstairs stacked in a line like dominoes. There's a particular spittoon that's upstairs that every time they move it somewhere else in the house, it ends up right back where it was before. And the lights turning on and off by themselves and all kind of stuff. Seeing apparitions. I actually experienced quite a bit. I've investigated Lotes House, and we experienced quite a bit at Lotes House. It's a pretty interesting place. I took my cousin for his first paranormal investigation there, and he actually saw the full body apparition of a woman in the bedroom upstairs walk across the doorway. He told me, he tapped me on the shoulder, and we ran in there. There wasn't anybody in there, and there was only three of us guys upstairs. All the women were downstairs. But yeah, all kinds of stuff at Lotes House. You hear bangs and cannon fire and things like that. There was also a sniper who perched up in the second floor of the Lotes House and picked off a lot of soldiers. I believe he was a Confederate sniper, and he picked off a lot of Union soldiers before they took him out. And there's a message scratched in the floor over by the bed. And I forget what the message says, but it's scratched in the floor, in the wood floor. And there's some blood stains over there too. So they think that's maybe where he was perched up.
Oh,
there.
Yeah.
One of the incredible things is the wife's diary, her journal, she kind of journaled a lot of it. And they had I think, three small kids at the time when the battle happened. So the next morning when the battle was over and they wanted to go survey the damage of their house, the wife put in her journal that they walked to their house, which was probably about 50 yards from Carter House, about half the football field, and their feet never touched the ground because they walked on dead bodies.
When you just said that they wanted to go assess the damage, I thought of exactly that, the carnage yeah. that they would have seen
yeah.
would have just been so overwhelming. And I think they went on to live in the house, didn't they? And I think the Carter family did as well.
Yeah. They the Lotes, they lived for a little while in the house. They just kind of hurriedly patched the house up, which you can still see when you take a tour nowadays, the floor, even though he's a master woodworker, he had to get the house in livable condition, so he just quickly patched up the floor. Well, not long after the Battle of Franklin, he actually carved, well, right when the Civil War was over, he actually carved a piano for a client. And the piano leg was a eagle clutching the Confederate flag. Mm-hmm. And that was sacrilegious to the Confederates because they got defeated, and that was just a reminder. So they kind of ran him out of town.
Oh,
so him and his family ended up moving to California, and they packed up. And so he never really fixed the house properly as a woodworker would have. But especially, like I said, you still see the patches in the floors and the ceilings and stuff, which is just crudely done with wood. But yeah, they kind of ran him out of town, threatening his family, because even after Civil War, you still had, you know, the South was still Confederate. A lot of them, you know, mm-hmm. especially freshly after the war. But that was kind of a slight against them. And they threatened his family. But their daughter ended up becoming a somewhat famous painter.
I think maybe I did see something she had done while I was there. I remember them pointing out could they have one in the Carter House?
Yeah, they may have one of her paintings in there.
Yeah. Because when you think about these horrific battles, it didn't just go away the next day. I just couldn't imagine, you know, what they had to live with and you know, they don't have the emergency services that we do now. Just having to go back and live in that house, like in the Carter family house, like having to live there. Well, through all that, and having kids.
Yeah, yeah. And also what a lot of people don't know is that the Confederates did not have money. They barely had money to feed their troops and clothe them and for weapons and things. So they just buried their dead right where they died. Mm-hmm. And so come the next summer, these bodies after the winter, a lot of them hands and feet and things were sticking out of the ground because they buried them in really shallow graves and went on because they had to move on to the next battle, which was Battle of Nashville. So the town, it smelled like dead bodies. It smelled like rotting.
Oh God, horses. Can you imagine?
And something had to be done about it. And so the McGavicks, who own Carton Plantation, actually donated 2.5 acres of their property and paid a doctor and two assistants. I think it was $3 a body, which was a lot of money back then, to dig up the bodies and reinter them at Carton. And they're still there to this day. There's still a cemetery there to this day. They identified the soldiers they could and tried to get a hold of their families if they want to come get their bodies. And so that happened with a lot of the soldiers, but I think there's over 2,000 that are buried in the cemetery at Carton, and they didn't have dog tags and things back then. So if they didn't have like an identifier, their name wasn't sewn in their clothes, or they didn't have a letter on them with their name on it, you know, from family or whatever, they just buried them with their regiments and stuff. So the cemetery is divided up into states, what state they were from and what regiment they were with. So it's a lot of unmarked graves and unknown soldiers.
So fascinating. I would recommend a trip to Franklin to anyone. I thought it was it was a great little day trip. But I remember us getting in the car after we left, and we were both really kind of shook by the experience too, kind of wrapping our brain around what had happened. So I totally see why all those locations could be haunted.
And it's not just those locations. I mean, all of downtown Franklin. If you go take the Franklin ghost tour, or even the history tour, you'll see all the buildings that were involved. And there's some other interesting characters, interesting stories about some of those houses down there. But I had to kind of narrow it down to just a few locations, you know, in each city. And so I just picked two that I was very familiar with Carton Plantation and Lode's House.
The other location I wanted to talk about was Loretta Lynn's Ranch.
Yeah.
And where is that?
It is in Hurricane Mills, Tennessee. So basically her and her husband bought this whole town, which is interesting.
Right.
It's considered in Middle Tennessee. It's outside of Waverly, Tennessee. But they bought this whole town of Hurricane Mills. And it was called that after the mill that ran through town. But they ended up buying the post office, church, and everything and turned it into the Loretta Lynn Ranch. And it's an interesting story of how they found it. They were actually looking for another house one night when she, back at the kind of the height of her fame, back in the 60s, 70s, I think it was in the 60s, they bought the house, but they were looking for another house they were going to look at. And they stumbled upon the house that became Hurricane Mills. The doors were locked and it was empty and it was abandoned. And they ended up sleeping on the front porch because it was raining. It was late at night. And that's when they decided to buy the house. She fell in love with it. It was 1966. That happened, and they ended up buying the rest of the town too, because it was just kind of a little defunct, you know, just a little hole in the wall town, and made it this huge property that they owned. And her family, you know, she raised her kids there and things like that. They ended up back in the 90s, it got turned into, she still lived there and still owned the house, and it's a museum now. You can go visit, go through the museum. But back in the 90s, they opened up a big like sports park, and they have like motocross and four-wheeler races. So motorcycle racing and things like that there now. And it's a huge place for that, for trail riding and things like that too.
Now, Loretta Lynn, I think you mentioned she had her own experiences with the paranormal. Yep. And I think it was a really kind of a generational thing, would you say?
Yeah, they claim that her mother was a psychic as well. Her mother actually predicted Loretta Lynn's son's death. The first time she visited the farm, they took her down to Hurricane Creek, which is it's a rather large creek. And she had a premonition that one of Loretta's kids would die. One of her sons would drown. And quite a few years later, he did drown in the Hurricane Creek.
Wow.
Yeah, and then Loretta claimed to be psychic herself. That she would see a lot of, she kind of knew things before they happened. She would wake up in the middle of the night with premonitions and things. And she would see spirits quite often on the property too. She didn't really claim to kind of talk to them because I think she was kind of scared of it in a way. I don't think she was scared of the spirits, but I think she was afraid of talking to them. But but she had seances at the house and things to contact the spirits of the house. One came forward and actually shook the table and slammed it to the floor, breaking the table in half. And they believe that was the ghost of the home builder, James Anderson. And that was kind of the only violent encounter. Most of them.
So that would be pretty sick, pretty terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. One time, Loretta Lynn, she saw this woman outside at night, and she went outside and followed her. And she actually saw her upstairs first, and she thought they had a visitor. And she asked the nanny who was upstairs, but the nanny told her there was nobody in the home. It was just them. And so she went outside and saw the same lady walking through the cemetery, and the lady vanished. And she decided to do some research to find out who the woman was. And she discovered a woman named Beulah Anderson who lived in the house, and she'd given birth to a stillborn baby and died only a few days later. And the mother and the child are both buried in the cemetery on the property. Yeah.
That would be really fascinating to have that experience and then uncover that information. Like we're talking about the history, how it does play into the paranormal, and they kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah. Yeah. And they have some mischievous ghosts there too. One time some of the staff was out on the balcony up top because it's a huge, they have a huge porch, and a ghost locked them out on the porch.
Oh my God.
There was nobody else at the house. It was just the three of them.
And you're stuck. Like what? Somebody got to crawl down or?
Yeah. They had to, I think they had to wait until Loretta came home or her husband and they saw them up there stuck. But yeah, the door locked itself. They have no explanation because they've been going in and out of the door because they were decorating for something. And they've been going in and out the door. Nobody locked the door. But yeah, they believe it was the ghost that locked the door and locked them out there on the balcony.
Yeah. How does that happen?
There's lots of sightings of Civil War soldiers, especially by Loretta Lynn's children. Her poor sons lived in this. They stayed in this room called the Brown Room. And one night, her son Jack woke up. He fell asleep with his clothes on like kids do. You know, he's probably 8, 9 years old. And he woke up one night in that room, and a Confederate soldier was pulling his boots off of him.
Wow.
And so, you know, and the children started refusing to sleep in that room.
Don't blame him.
And that's considered by the family, Loretta Lynn's family, has been the most haunted room in the house, because people that slept in there, especially men, always had experiences. But they have knocks and see apparitions and all kind of stuff. They're pretty open about it too. Her grandson has a lot to do with the house and the tours and things nowadays, and he talks a lot about the hauntings and his grandmother and stuff that happened to her. So he's kind of carrying on the stories in that tradition.
I was going to ask about that, if there was any contemporary stories. Or because you know how a lot of locations, they really don't want to talk about the paranormal stuff. They kind of act like it doesn't happen. What? Us haunted? No.
Yeah.
When you know damn well it is. So I was wondering about that as you were talking about it, if they acknowledge it.
They do. They do. And I don't, I think on the history tours, if you ask them about it, they'll tell you about it. They have done. I don't know if they continue to do it to this day, but before they had done paranormal tours around September, October in spooky season, they'd done some like candle, lantern light tours where they told the ghost stories and stuff. But stuff happens in the middle of the day up there. One of the stories is the her grandson. So her son, who is still living, the one that's still alive, he was talking to a group of people, and he was standing a couple of steps up on the stairs in the house. And the group of like 10 or 15 tourists were standing right inside the house. And there's a bunch of paintings and pictures that go up the stairs. And it's this like grand staircase. And he claimed he doesn't believe in the paranormal. And so he was talking trash about this one ghost that people believe in the house. Well, because they say that one of the ghosts, if you straighten up the pictures, the ghost will come back and make them crooked on the wall. And he was telling the tourists how he didn't believe that. And all of a sudden, this snake comes out of nowhere under the stairs and chases them all outside.
Oh.
And another tour guide was standing on the stairs talking to this group of tourists. And she didn't say anything bad, but she was talking about the paintings, and she got pushed off the stairs. Something came up from, and this is the middle of the day, something coming from behind her and just pushed her, and she just kind of stumbled down the 2-3 stairs.
That seems like the same guy who broke the table during Loretta's seance. Like, yeah, like there's somebody who's not so nice here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can make a point without sending a snake or pushing someone.
Right, right. Yeah, and the snake, they had no idea how it got in the house. Or, you know.
That's yeah. Just creepy. That's just creepy. Now, is there any story in the book that you found particularly interesting that I have not brought up?
Yeah, there is Cherry Mansion, which is in Savannah, which is right where Shiloh Battlefield is. It's a very interesting house, and it was used as a headquarters before and after the Battle of Shiloh. And the story goes that Ulysses S. Grant was actually eating breakfast the morning of the Battle of Shiloh when it started, and nobody had attacked anybody yet, but he's eating breakfast in the Cherry Mansion, and when he heard the cannon fire. And Cherry Mansion overlooks the river and the battlefield. It's up on a big hill. And so he had to rush down to the battlefield when he heard cannon fire to, you know, direct the army. But there were two generals that were with him, W.H.L. Wallace and Benjamin Prentice, were two generals that were with him. And they were both wounded, and they would end up dying at Cherry Mansion. Well, the interesting thing is that General Wallace's wife, Martha Ann, she had a premonition of her husband's death, and she traveled for like 48 straight hours to Tennessee in hopes that she would see her husband alive. But she had this premonition that he was going to die. She came all the way from Virginia to southern middle Tennessee to Shiloh to see, make sure her husband's still alive. And luckily she got to the house a couple of days before he died when he was wounded. He was upstairs in the bedroom, wounded, and there's nothing they could do for him. So she got to see him and stay with him the last few days of his life. And it just, I thought that was interesting that she got this premonition that he was going to die and traveled all this way. And it's such a strong premonition that she traveled so far day and night to get to her husband.
And it wasn't like she jumped in a car.
Right.
You know, that was difficult travel.
Yeah. And people claim to still see him in the window upstairs.
I just find that fascinating. Because I think we've all had premonitions or an intuition maybe, but for it to be so strong, it's almost like they were connected in some way, and she knew he needed her.
There's another interesting story with Cherry Mansion as well. That's a newer haunting, a lot of them come from after the Civil War, people seeing Civil War soldiers throughout the years and things like that. So back in the 1970s, there were a bunch of people sitting on the front porch one evening after dinner, and it's around 10, 11 at night. So they see there's a historical marker out front of the house because of its significance with the Battle of Shiloh. But also the house was built in the 1820s. So it's a very old house, and it was a wedding gift from David Robinson to his daughter and her husband. But it's a historical house. So they have a historical marker. But they're sitting out on the porch about 11 o'clock, and it's a nice summer night. And they see this gray bearded man in a white suit and a hat is walking up the driveway toward the house. He stopped and looks like he was reading the historical marker and then just vanished right in front of their eyes.
Oh, that's interesting, because he's so real that they're like, look at that guy.
He looked solid as a real person. They thought it was a real person coming up, and they're like, what is this guy doing at 11 o'clock at night?
Exactly.
Yeah. And stopped to read the marker.
I love stories like that. I don't know if I'd love it if I saw it. I just love it.
Yeah.
I think it would be fascinating, though, if you saw it. It would be like, especially if there's someone with you to validate that you really, because that would be that, did you just see that?
Yeah. And this was four or five people that saw the same thing. Wow. Yeah.
Well, I think the book was great. The book is Small Town Haunts and Legends of Tennessee. Now, I got it on Amazon. I just downloaded it. Is that the best way to get it? Or do you have another, like a website or something?
I'm working on the website so people can order signed copies if they like. And that'll just be available in the U.S. because shipping elsewhere is just kind of prohibitive.
True.
But if you're anywhere else in the world than the U.S., Amazon's the best place to get it. U.S. Amazon as well. It's on hardback, paperback, Kindle, and Kindle Unlimited right now. If you have Kindle Unlimited, it is free.
It is free.
For the next few weeks.
Yeah, because when I went to download the book, I'm like, what? This is amazing.
Yeah.
And the podcast is the Unseen Paranormal Podcast, and you could do a deep dive into that.
Yeah. I did it for 5 years and have about 150 guests. There's 170 episodes, but 150-something guests because I had a couple of repeats. And it's kind of on hiatus right now, but I will bring it back at some point in time.
But yeah, there's so many episodes to listen to. By the time you bring it back, they still won't be caught up.
Yeah, yeah. And I find that now, I mean, it's still, I haven't done it in 6 months, but you know, the numbers are still there. People are still discovering it and listening and binge listening and, you know.
And one more thing I'm going to have you promise me is that you'll come back to talk about the Night House. Now this is a house that you and your husband bought with the idea to renovate it.
Yeah, to kind of save it because it's on 3 acres in the middle of Hopkinsville, Kentucky. And Hopkinsville has kind of seen a resurgence of building and people redoing old houses, but also of new houses. And it's always been a residence. It's never been open to the public. And it has this vast history of 210 years. It was built in 1815. And it's the oldest house still standing in the county and one of the oldest structures still standing in Kentucky. And we call it the Knight House. It was built in 1815, but the Knights bought it in 1860, and they lived there until it was sold out of their family in 1945. So for 85 years, the Knights occupied that house, and it saw their entire family. When they moved in, they had 7 kids, and it basically saw the death and the dying off of their entire family. Mm. And would see the wakes and all their happy times and sad times, and very interesting. A lot of history there. I could talk about the history for about 4 hours. The haunting is probably another 2-hour conversation, you know, so to do the whole story. But we started having things happen as soon as we bought the house. Actually, before we bought the house, I had some lucid dreams from the Knights themselves, basically telling me they wanted us to own the house. And we thought that the deal wasn't going to get made because we put an offer in and they refused to offer. But 2 weeks later, they came back and countered their own offer, even lower, which doesn't ever happen.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah. So we bought the house and we've been renovating it. And actually, April 24th is the year anniversary of us buying it last year. So we've had it for a year. We've done a lot. We've opened it for historic tours and for paranormal teams to rent it out. And it's an incredible place. It's a 5,600 square foot mansion. That the history's never been told of the people that live there, the Knights or the Rogers and the other people that live there. And so we're trying to open it up to the, not just the world, but, you know, to the community that those people served and helped kind of shape and mold, you know, Hopkinsville, Kentucky into what it is today.
I want to dive into that. So if you wouldn't mind doing another episode with me, I think it would be so interesting.
No, not at all. I'd love to.
That'd be great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. This was great.
Yeah, thank you, Carol.
And that wraps up our conversation with Eric Freeman Sims about his book, Small Town Haunts and Legends of Tennessee. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, then become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts where you can try it for 3 days free, or you could also go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.